is CBS Eye on the World. Here's John Batchelor.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. Ulubaran. Ulubaran is a ship wrecked in the Mediterranean. It is also a time machine, 1300 before the Common Era. The ship, however, reveals what is about to be a revelation to me again. After 1177 BC, The Survival of Civilization by Professor Eric Klein. This is a sequel to a book Eric and I spoke of many years ago, which includes the Ulubaran shipwreck. 1177 BC, the year civilization collapsed. That's 1177, so 123 years before. This ship is understood to have not met its conditions and sunk. It's been recovered to a great extent. Its cargo is the Bronze Age. Professor, a very good evening to you. Thank you very much. This is a sentimental trip on my part because I wanted to talk to you again about your original genius, 1177 BC. And then I learned that you had a sequel. So here we are, not only the end of civilization, but its reawakening and revelations that may or may not be useful here in the 21st century. What is in the Ulubaran that demonstrates globalization at the time? Good evening to you, Professor.
Well, good evening, and thank you for having me on again. It's wonderful to be back some 10 years later with the sequel. The Ulubaran shipwreck basically is a microcosm of what was taking place during the late Bronze Age, say between 1500 BC and 1200 BC, give or take. On that ship, which went down in about 1300 BC, we have items from no fewer than 7 or 8 different civilizations. And it really shows it's a microcosm of the globalized network that was connecting all of the societies that went from the Western Mediterranean to the Eastern Mediterranean, some 3,200, 3,300 years ago, including Mycenaeans, Minoans, Egyptians, Assyrians, Hittites, and so on. So as I say, for me, that shipwreck is a microcosm of what was going on at that time that it sank.
Copper ingots. Why, Eric?
Lots of copper ingots because you need them to make bronze. 90% copper, 10% tin will get you bronze. You can use arsenic instead of tin if you have to, but I wouldn't recommend that. You're not going to live very long. And the copper at that time, most of it is coming from Cyprus. So the ship had more than 300 copper oxide ingots weighing about 60 pounds each. It also had, that was about 10 tons of copper. The ship also had about a ton of tin. And if you put those together, you would have had enough bronze to outfit an army of 300 soldiers. As George Bass, the excavator of the shipwreck, once said, you could outfit the army with swords and shields and helmets and greaves and all of that. So when this ship went down, somebody lost a fortune, that's for sure.
2 dozen ebony logs from Nubia. And I love this one. The revelation that the tin came from what is now Afghanistan.
More than likely, yes. From Afghanistan, Central Asia, maybe even up to, Turkmenistan. But from that general region, yes. Some of the tin in the late Bronze Age did come from what is now southeastern Turkey, ancient Anatolia, and there is some indication that at least upon occasion they may have gone as far as Cornwall in Britain. But as far as I'm concerned, the vast majority of the tin during the late Bronze Age is coming from Central Asia. So that's a very long trade route along which to bring the tin. And if it's cut at any point or at any time, you're going to be in real trouble.
And 140 Canaanite storage jars containing grapes, pomegranates, figs, coriander, and sumac, brand new pottery from Cyprus and Canaan. What we're describing is not just globalization, but sophisticated trade that Adam Smith would improve of.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. Those Canaanite storage jars are the shipping containers for the ancient world at that time. They can contain almost anything, as you just itemized, from food to glass beads. There was at least one jar that held thousands of glass beads. Also, terebinth resin from the pistachio tree, which you can use to help make perfume. So what we've got on board the ship and what was going around the Mediterranean is not only raw goods, especially metals, you know, gold, silver, copper, and tin, but also finished goods, including, as you just mentioned, pottery, ceramic lamps, and things like that.
And now the world ends, but not before we note that we've heard about this time not just from Homer, but also from Egypt, because there's a small item on board, a scarab belonging to Nefertiti herself. Who is that, Eric?
Oh, extremely important small item. Yeah, Nefertiti, the wife of Akhenaten, the so-called heretic pharaoh, and they are ruling in the middle of the 14th century B.C. This particular scarab is very important for two reasons. One, it's solid gold, which is rather unusual. But secondly, her name is spelled Neferu-Neferu-Aten, which is the name that she used for the first 5 years of her rule when her husband Akhenaten was busy messing with the religion of ancient Egypt at that time. So to find an item like that on board the ship is one thing that we dream of, because it helps us to date the wreck. We know that the wreck could not have gone down, you know, before her rule. It has to be after she started ruling. And chances are pretty good that she was dead by the time her scarab made it on board, because, well, we don't know if they would have sent a scarab like that out during her lifetime. But regardless, it is one of the items on the wreck that allows us to date it, along with radiocarbon dating of the timbers from the hull and even dendrochronology, both from the timbers and some of the brush that was up on top of the ship. So we've got three or four different ways to date the shipwreck, including used Mycenaean and Minoan pottery. So all told, with that scarab and the others, that's why we know it goes down in about 1300 BC.
Now the world ends, and that's important here. This is the climax of the first volume, 1177. 1177 is the date, 22 years later, but it's a combination. How many elements came together to form that perfect storm, Eric?
Lots. So 1177, that year, comes from the fact that that is the second time the Egyptians tell us that a bunch of groups that we lump together collectively and call the Sea Peoples, the Egyptians tell us this is the second time that they attacked in two waves, one by land and one by sea. And this is Ramses III that is telling us the story in 1177 BC. But the Sea Peoples are just one part of the collapse. And in fact, they might be as much victims as they are oppressors, because there is also drought, famine, invaders / migrants, which is what the Sea Peoples are, disease, earthquakes. It literally is a perfect storm of catastrophic events that happen either virtually simultaneously or one after the other so quickly that they didn't have time to recover from one calamity before the next one hit.
And this is the overarching theme of Eric's work here, that the image that I like that he gives us is a watch with 8 or 9 moving gears. And can it survive losing one gear? And it would appear that it cannot, Eric. Did you come to a conclusion? Could they have lost any one of these, the Minoans, the Hittites, the Assyrians? Any one could have bowed out and the others would have gone on in this global trade? Have you come to an opinion?
Yes, actually, I have, courtesy of the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, with whom I just finished a study that's actually just been published a couple of months ago, in which we did computer modeling, seeing exactly that, testing. If the Mycenaeans dropped out, would that bring the whole network down? Or if the Egyptians dropped out? And it turns out, after running thousands of simulations, that really the only one that works is if the Hittites and the port city of Ugarit go down almost simultaneously, which we know they did. And those two dropping out at just about the same time is enough to take down the whole network. But when running the simulations, if the Mycenaeans drop out, that's not enough to affect the whole thing. Same with the Egyptians, same with the Cypriots. The only scenario is if two go down at once, and in particular, the Hittites and Ugarit. So that was an interesting finding that is in neither of the books, because we just finished it and just published it.
Ugarit is the trading port, the nexus for the trade routes itself. And that was damaged. My memory, because it's been 10 years, forgive me, Professor, my memory is that it was the earthquake that hit Ugarit. Is that correct?
Well, an earthquake did hit Ugarit, but it was slightly earlier. We know there was one in the middle of the 14th century. But in fact, we have new data, and that is one of the reasons why I put out the revised version of the original book in 2021, because several more texts, which had been untranslated, were published by the French in 2016, which was after the original book came out, and then retranslated into English by 2019-2020 by a friend of mine, Yuri Cohen. And those new texts, which make it into the revised version, talk about famine in Ugarit. They explicitly say there's famine, and they ask the Egyptians for help. But even more importantly, they mention that an invader, an unnamed invader, they just call him the enemy, has overrun their own port city, a place called Ras Ibn Hani, and that they are on their way to Ugarit. Please send help. Please send reinforcements. And they send that to the Hittites up in Carchemish. Well, obviously, reinforcements did not get there because the city is burnt to the ground. There's a meter, 3 feet of destruction with ash and you know, everything else, including arrowheads embedded in the walls. So Ugarit is hit by pretty much everything that could have hit it within the span of 100 years. You're right, there's an earthquake, there's drought, there's famine, and there's invaders. So I say in the revised version of the original book that they pretty much are the poster child for what could have gone wrong and, in fact, did go wrong at the end of the Late Bronze Age.
The new work is after 1177 BC, the survival of civilizations. We're about to see who wins and who loses after the catastrophes. Eric Klein is the author. I'm John Batchelor.